First, know the monster. What is our big fear? Why are many Christians afraid of science? Well, science is very successful, so that a lot of people subscribe to everything that science says and find scientists for every opinion you want to have. And we saw that in COVID, some said you should not be vaccinated, others say you should be vaccinated, and so on. So, yeah, you find science everywhere. But science is successful, it explains everything on natural grounds only. No specters, no strange beings, dwarfs or whatever, no Michael's being behind the scene, no ghosts. Humanity should accept that science has eliminated the justification for believing in cosmic purpose, and that any survival of purpose and faith and so on is inspired solely by sentiment. So you're just following a sentiment if you still believe in God or in a purpose. That's what quite a few people would still subscribe to. And so the frequent reactions to that is fear. Oh, have they refuted the existence of God? Can I not continue to believe? Or am I going to look stupid? One, fear. One reason why we are afraid. The other thing might be that we don't know enough how to relate to a scientist, because we have different starting points. Yeah, we come from the Bible and believe God has revealed himself. A scientist says, there is no revelation. We just need to go out and do experiments, and that's what we can know about the world. And there is no God. I've never digged out the hand of God or something like that. And hence, what's happening? A lot of people do ignore scientists as hopeless cases for the gospel, and science in general is irrelevant for what we do in Christianity. Or they even seem to be unwelcome enemies. But it should not be like that. And you all know that Jesus taught us, love your neighbor, even love your enemy, by the way, and even though they might be scientists. So scientists are human beings like you and me. Scientists are often lonely, isolated. They know amazing things about God's creation that you don't know yet, so it's interesting to talk to them and get to know what they research, actually. They have questions themselves. Often are they interested in the big questions, like what is the meaning of everything? Why is there anything and not nothing? These are good questions to discuss with scientists. And of course, they need Jesus. So be interested in them and don't be afraid. That's my personal message to you if you encounter scientists. So say no, the foundations and the presuppositions. Everyone believes. Everyone has a worldview. Also, scientists have worldviews, and they might even have different worldviews among themselves. They are different people. They start from somewhere. So, for example, every scientist assumes that our mind can understand nature and decode nature, find the basic principles, and to know truth. And this is not self-evident, as you can see in a few moments. Then every scientist believes that there are deeper laws behind the complex phenomena of the universe, and phenomena can be reduced to simple principles. This is not self-evident, that's faith. Faith that actually worked out in the past. And a lot of scientists believe that these laws are simple and beautiful and comprehensible. Again, something you need to believe and we have no warrant for, especially if we are materialists. Why should we believe these things if everything there is just atoms and energy? And often an additional assumption is, or worldview presupposition, there are only natural causes. I mean, science focuses on analyzing natural causes, but that makes scientists sometimes believe we only deal with natural causes, hence, there are only natural causes. But that, of course, is not a syllogism. This is just wrong reasoning. All this matter. You've taught that probably already, the wrong reasons and so on, and critical thinking and so on. So how can we be sure that there is nothing beyond? It's a good question. How can we be sure? Which scientific theory proves that there is nothing beyond the universe? Could there be a mind beyond matter? That's a good question to ask, and it might be a door opener to discuss. So ask worldview questions when you come together with scientists. What do you believe and why do you believe it? What is the ultimate cause for everything, or matter? What is a human being, a chance product, or the image of God? What can we know, and why can we know it? What should we do? Where do we get our morals from? Does biology teach us morals? What is our destiny? Where are we going to? Do we have hope, life after death, eternity, and so on? These are questions that most scientists like to think about. Use them in discussing scientists, and you can probably give a reason for the hope that you have. The second part of the foundations, the plausibility argument versus conclusive proof, or why you married your spouse. Usually scientists would say, well, I can't refute the existence of God, but the burden of proof is on you. What is there, a conclusive proof of God's non-existence, or is there a conclusive proof of God's existence? How can you actually prove God or disprove him? And should be on that basis actually exclude God from explaining reality? I would say no. We should ask a different question. And that's important. The question leads to the answer already. We should ask whether God's existence is more plausible than his non-existence. That's the right way to ask. Because science can neither prove or disprove God, as we'll see. And that's the basis on which we reason all the time. For example, when you think about, should I marry my spouse or not? There is no conclusive proof that your spouse will always remain with you throughout all your life. You have no conclusive proof, and still you make the decision and say, yes, I marry you. So we always make our decisions not on conclusive proofs, but on plausibility arguments. And the same is true for the existence of God. I just can't get God out of my pocket and show you, here is God, so believe in him. And so it is a question of worldview, and there are maybe two main different worldviews. One is theism, which believes that mind is primary and created matter, and matter is secondary. And the other big worldview is materialism. There is only matter, and so mind is actually a late phenomenon of complex configurations of matter. Like mind is a product of material processes, like rain firing and so on producing mind. And that's why Richard Dawkins comes to the conclusion the existence of God is very, very, very improbable, because our own existence is already very improbable, and we are mindful beings, and God is a greater mind, so his existence is even more improbable than our own. Very strange reasoning. God is a product of evolutionary processes. So, comparing plausibility, how does that work? Well, we can make observations about reality, and then we need to compare observations to the different worldviews and see what's more plausible. Is it more plausible that there is a God? Does that have more explanatory power? Or is it more plausible that there is no God, that matter is all that there is? Atheism, yeah? So this is no conclusive proof, and plausibility is always to a certain degree subjective too. But at least we can have a discussion and discuss whether observation one is more plausible or the other. Okay, so I think this is what the debate should be all about, not about proving or disproving, but about plausibility arguments. Know the limit. What is the scope of science? Science works empirically. Yeah, that means we observe nature or we set up experiments and then we look what happens. And from the data that we measure, we construct theories. Theories are not implied in the data, but we have to find the correct theories, so creativity is necessary for that. And when we have a theory, we cannot be sure that this is the correct theory, but we must actually test the theory again against the data. So it's a circular process. And so it could happen that we think that cat always eat goldfish, because we have observed that 1,000 times. And finally we arrive at that goldfish over there, to the bottom of that slide. And you see, okay, sometimes a goldfish can be underestimated by a cat. And so suddenly, at the 1,000th first time, we realize we have to change our theory. It's not only the cat eat goldfish, but some goldfish are clever enough to eat the cat yet. A new observation can always disprove an old theory. And that means, if you think that thought through, that it's a circular process repeating itself every time, 1,000 times and beyond, that science can never, never ever conclusively disprove the existence of anything, because there could be a new observation which actually shows that it exists anyway, even though 1,000 times we thought it does not exist. There can always be new evidence. Science can always be falsified, scientific theories, disproved by new observations, but it can never be ultimately arriving at the truth, at the ultimate truth, because it's a circular process. That's the criteria for falsification, Karl Popper, for those of you who want to know that. And then a good question to ask is, you want me to prove the existence of God, so what would count for you as proof or as a refutation of God's existence for you? And usually people have to think hard, how actually could I prove or disprove the existence of God? Right, the methods of physics. Which lab experiment should I set up in order to disprove the existence of God? And even clever atheist scientists agree that we just don't have the experiment for that. Of course, often they would withdraw to historical issues like, you know, the ancient Greeks, they believed that the thunder would be produced by Zeus and so on, and we have shown that this is not true, it's just a shift of charges in the atmosphere, and when the shift gets large enough, then lightning and thunder get around. It's just electromagnetism. And so Zeus is superfluous. But this is just one example of all that, and it's not a refutation of the existence of God. It just shows that God could even establish mechanisms, for example. And then the main question is the world itself self-explanatory? Does it explain why it exists, this world, as a product of matter? And so if someone asks me, actually, please prove the existence of God to me, then I would ask a question back. I would say, okay, we can try if you tell me what I should prove, actually. But let me first ask you a question. Can you prove the existence of Van Gogh by doing measurements on that painting with physics, chemistry, biology? And then usually, as a physicist, you can count the atoms, you can weigh the weight, and so on. You can do all that, yes. As a chemist, you can analyze the molecules and everything, but you only can come up with measurable and quantifiable data, but you can never come up with this painting has been painted by Van Gogh. Where do we know that from? We know that from historical evidence, because there were people who saw that this is painted by Van Gogh and believe it because the testimony seems to be true. So it's not a scientific argument that leads to the conclusion that this has been painted by Van Gogh, because Van Gogh is not a part of his own painting. He's the creator, the painter of that painting. And the same is true for God. God is not a part of his creation, but he's the creator, so he's transcendent. He's beyond creation. And this is very important to keep in mind. We cannot prove someone who is beyond his creation if we only can measure creation itself. Like we can't measure Van Gogh in his painting. But of course we could argue that we can actually find traces within the painting that point to Van Gogh. And if you are an expert in arts, you might already realize there are some structures that are so typical for Van Gogh that this painting must be from Van Gogh, even if we haven't known that it's from him. Or it's by a man of the same name, that Gogh. Science has made the notion of God superfluous. Well, I would say no, it didn't. It just showed that there are different ways how God can actually deal with nature, and it shows that scientific explanations and faith explanations, religious explanations, can actually complement each other. And a very easy thing to explain that is, why is the water in the tea kettle boiling? You can ask a scientist and he says, well, there is heat energy that is generated by the stove, and then the water gets warmer, 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 until phase transition, and then the water starts to boil when we reach phase transition. And so you have the theory of thermodynamics answering the question. But you can also say, well, actually, the water in the kettle is boiling because I switched from the stove. And now someone says, oh, these are two completely different explanations. Only one can be true. Which one is correct? What do you think? Well, the answer is yes, both are true. So one is described with the agent, and the other one is described with the mechanism by which the agent is actually doing the things. And this can be true for God as well in nature. So sometimes science and faith are just complementary explanations. Third, has science shown that religions are just myths and science is the way to truth? We must admit that even in Genesis, we realize that even Genesis starts to demystify the world because the sun and the moon and so on are just heavenly bodies, lamps, hanging around somewhere, and there are no gods. So science is actually extrapolating the project that has been started by Pilot to demystify the natural world and to open it up for research. The stars are no gods. But many rational questions are not accessible by scientific means. That starts by the question, is it actually a scientific result that only science leads to true knowledge? Which experiment shows that? I don't know the experiment. It's actually not a result of science, but it's philosophy. So, and other many rational questions are not accessible by scientific means. For example, moral values. We can calculate the risk whether a nuclear power plant blows up or not. And we can calculate what happens when a nuclear power plant blows up. But is it good to build them and use them, or is it bad to build them or not? Germans and French people think very differently about that issue, actually, as you can easily find out when you look at the number of power plants in the different countries. And then the question of beauty. You can try to use the golden ratio or something to explain why some things could be beautiful, but people might disagree with that. Which color is more beautiful, yellow or blue or white or red or whatever? Well, beauty is a matter of taste. It's not a scientific question. The question of meaning. Is life meaningful? Well, what do you want to calculate? The meaning is 42. Is it?
I don't know.
Just referring back to the first slide, and this nice cultural scientist, actually. He's not a scientist, a natural scientist. It's a poet. Poet, actually, I think. Poet. So we cannot understand our spouse by physics only. I can measure the length, the waist, I can measure the weight and everything, but I will not yet understand my wife. Just doing measurements. So physical knowledge, scientific knowledge is limited. It is great knowledge, but it's limited. And having clarified the limits of science in this way, I hope that gave you a few illustrations and so on you can use in the podcast. Let's now change the table and say, actually, there are even traces in scientific knowledge that point to the existence of a real creator. So let's turn the table and I ask you, is atheism really a better explanation than theism? So the first question, science means knowledge. Why do we know anything? The problem of epistemology and why everyone needs to believe in something. If our thinking, according to the materialist paradigm, is just a product of something else, of electrical currents firing in my brain, chemical potentials, or the drive to reproduce myself, and so on. Survival of the fittest, reproduction of the fittest, and so on. Why on earth should the logic that our brains produce, why should they be true? They should be very successful in helping us to be reproducing or surviving or whatever. By the way, most theoretical physicists who are considered to be very intelligent have not really been that successful in reproducing themselves, at least physically. So it doesn't go hand in hand. We have no reason to trust a theory because your atoms may believe it. You can always say, you don't believe that for good reasons, but you believe that because your atoms were firing that way. And if I want to change your opinion, I need to change your atoms, your neurons, and your brain. Yeah, because my atoms make you believe what I believe, and your atoms make you believe what you believe. That's all in materialism, and we cannot be sure that there is abstract logic, Aristotelian logic, and so on. So we have no reason on the grounds of materialism. It's really hard to find solid ground for reasoning. Second, what do we discover in science? So the first question is, why does science work at all? And the second is, why are there rational laws in nature? If everything is just chance and necessity and matter floating around and so on, empty space and atoms moving, then why is it that there are mathematical laws that can be described in terms of formula? There could be some regularities, even without, but that mathematics and abstract science, actually, an abstract, which is not science, because mathematics would be true even if there were no matter at all. Even in a spiritual world, mathematics would still be true. No objects moving around at all. So Einstein said the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. And what he means by that is that science is successful. We can predict the next solar eclipse and so on with high accuracy and where it happens, and can read it on the internet today. But even ancient people could do that, at least the wise people of the. But we don't know why that works. We have no explanation for that. Why should nature and matter actually conform to mathematical laws? It is interesting that pioneers of science, most of them were from the Jewish Christian background, actually, like Copernicus, Kepler, Newton, and so on, the so-called Christian Europe 500 years ago. And they were not surprised to find laws. It was not that they looked at nature and then, oh, what a miracle, I found a law there. No, it was the other way around. Because of their concept of God, they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. That's how C.S. Lewis actually phrased it. And that's a great word to say. Why did science start? Because there were people who expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. So Christianity actually inspired the start of science. And that was missing to many other cultures, even though they had good technological knowledge, like the Chinese, for example, or like the ancient Greeks. But they had different concepts of the world. So as Christians, we can be sure that there is a truth, Veritas. This is the ancient beacon, or the original beacon of the Harvard University. I love it. It's so telling, actually. And there are three books. Veritas is written on three books, the truth. One is God's revelation, God's word. That's what we cannot find out by ourselves, but what God has to communicate to us. The second book, God's word, we are actually commanded to go out and deal with nature. Yeah, we should rule nature, so we need to go out and deal with it and find out about it. And then Adam is commanded to name the animals. This is start be a biologist, actually. So Adam definitely was also a biologist, apart from other things. And third, we are created in God's image. So we can think God's thoughts after him, as Johannes Kepler said. We can think God's thoughts after him. Johannes Kepler, that's also a great quote, because it shows that the first scientists were inspired by Christian thoughts. Our mind is not that big as God's mind, and it can be false, of course, but it's still big enough and created similar enough to God's mind that we can think his thoughts after him. Okay. Now about science. Well, a good question to ask is a third question. Why does the universe exist at all? Is it actually self-explained? This is the problem of the origin of the universe. And the argument is the Kalam cosmological argument. You can read more about that with William Blake Craig. First, everything that has a beginning has a cause. We reason with that all the time in physics. If something is there that wasn't there, we think, why is it there? What is the cause for it? And second, we found out in science that the universe actually has a beginning. It's called the Big Bang, for example. And so if both premises are true and we can make a good case for that, what caused the universe? The cause should be transcendent. It should be part of the universe, because otherwise the universe would create itself, which causes difficult philosophical problems. So it must be beyond space, time, and matter. Space and time only exist when there is matter, actually, according to physical theories. And so it must be beyond that, otherwise it would be a part of the universe which is to come into existence. And it must be effective, it must have an effect. And so a person with a mind and intentionality is a good candidate for that. It's a personal God who is eternal, omnipresent, all-knowing, all-powerful, is actually a good candidate. That's not a proof, but I would say it's more plausible that there is a God who created the universe than the universe pulling itself out of nothing, as even some astrophysicists have claimed. But of course, that's a large debate, but you can make a good case for that. And there are people from both sides. I think I will skip these quotes now. If you want to have the slides, I can send them to you where you can read that. You can also read a lot of that in John Lennox's book, by the way, A Science Theory, God or Cosmic Chemistry. So when you do more research about the universe, you not only find out that it has a beginning, but fourth, that the universe is actually fine-tuned. Not only the universe itself, but also planet Earth and the solar system are fine-tuned. So we have two different kinds of fine-tuning. The general fine-tuning, which allows for the existence of life, and the specific fine-tuning, the terrestrial fine-tuning of our system. The observation of the universe tells us that the ratios of the fundamental constants are balanced to astonishing accuracy. Point is, we cannot predict or deduce by any abstract principle the value of the magnitude of the gravitational force. How strong should gravitation actually be? There's a constant, and we can measure the constant, but we have no theory to derive that value. And the same is true for the electrical charge, for example. And for all the forces, for all the masses of the elementary particle, those seem to be all arbitrary. And so physicists came and set up a phase space diagram and changing all these values, because in principle they could be different. So they change them and they find out, as soon as we change those parameters, we find out, well, the universe would look completely different. And there would be no structure of matter, for example. For example, when they changed the so-called cosmological constant, the dark energy, as it is usually called in popular media, which drives the universe apart, it drives the expansion of the universe, actually, counter to the gravitational force that pulls the universe together, because matter always attracts each other. They found out that this fine-tuning is as large as 1 to 10 to the power of 60. And the physicist Paul Davis actually compared that to a soldier trying to hit a 1 cent coin, not on the sun or the Andromeda galaxy, but on the other end, at the other end of the universe, which is very, very, very far away. And then you have a large sphere, and 1 cent coin is just the 10th power of 60th part of that sphere. Or another example would be, take all the mass of the universe, and about the 10 to the power of 16th part of that mass of the universe is a hair. So by one hair, we would not be here. And this is just one parameter. I mean, this cosmological constant is the most extreme fine-tuning problem, but there are many other parameters. A lot of them to the basic structure of the universe, and a lot of them to the specific fine-tuning of Earth. If you want to know more about that, you might, and you don't want to read books, I always recommend reading books, but if you want to see a movie, you can see the movie Our Fascinating Universe, in which we go about these things. And it's basically like cracking a mold. Yeah? All the numbers must be correct. If one number does not fit, the mold will not open, and there will be no life. And if all the numbers of the universe are correct but one, we will probably have no life. At least no life as we know it, but everything is speculation whether there are other forms of life. As Christians, we know there are other forms of life, like angels and so on, but they are not dependent on the material universe. First, talking about life. In which way is life itself pointing beyond a naturalistic explanation? And this is the problem of the origin of information. It is a scientific fact, and even the scientists themselves call it the way that the probings and everything that is there, that's necessary, that we can function as organisms. These proteins do not occur in normal chemical reactions. They only are there because they are produced in living cells, and they are produced because they are actually blueprints. They are building blocks that are stored in the nucleus of the cell, in the DNA and RNA. And this is called hereditary information. So no one would doubt that this is hereditary information. But whenever you find information, and the human genome has about 3 billion letters of information, coded algorithmic information, on a material medium, but whenever you find that, be it the DNA, be it a sheet of paper, or be it a silicon chip, or whatever, whenever you find information, you usually would conclude there is an intelligent center, there is a mind behind that. So that's another strong argument. Where does information come from? Information comes from intelligence. The only exception in all of the universe would, up to now, be life, if it was created by natural processes only. So who has the burden of proof? Has this burden of proof on the side of the naturalist or on the side of the Christian? Well, if you are a scientist and believe that the universe is a closed system, you will always say the burden of proof is on the person who believes information comes from an intelligent source. But if you say all we know about information from empirical science, informatics, and so on, then actually the burden of proof is on the person who claims information comes from natural processes. Another thing you could mention in the podcast. And then a frequent question, does biological evolution actually refute God's existence? Often you say, well, we now know where all this comes from. It comes from evolution. Well, information does not come from the evolution because the evolution works because the information is there already. So life is actually the existence of DNA and proteins that can read DNA is the prerequisite that evolution works from the beginning. And so the logic is usually evolution is a fact, hence there is no God. This is the logical argument. But is that really a conclusive argument? Because I can say, if there is a God, why could God not establish a mechanism for life to adapt? We have just talked about the tea kettle, the water boiling in the tea kettle. A mechanism does not refute the existence of an author. So evolution per se, as a natural mechanism, can never ever refute the existence of an agent, of an author, of a creator. The creator could use and establish a mechanism as we do in computer science all the time. The computer works and thinks and does everything, but it doesn't really think but process information, does itself. But there's still a creator of the computer, for example. In fact, another logic seems correct. If you are an atheist, if you are a materialist, then you have only one choice. Where does all that come from? Well, evolution must be true. So as a Christian, you have several options. Evolution could be true, but it could be interventions, because God is free to choose what to do, direct intervention or indirect creation, and so on. But if you presuppose atheism, you have only one game that you can play. There are no alternatives. And if Greek philosophers like Epicurus and Lucretius and so on, and Democritus, Leucippus, all of them, they devised already evolutionary theories, so it's actually an ancient idea. They just didn't have the scientific evidence for that. But it's a very ancient idea that matter develops and produces everything. And then the question becomes more technical, and you need to do some reading about that if you want to get into that debate, that actually the mechanisms of variation selection, they can be observed, they are real, but the question is, how far do they reach? Can they actually come up with new building plans? That's a big question, but I will skip that because it becomes too complex and won't have time for questions. So I come back to a seventh argument that you could ask. Is our consciousness, and that's a fact of the universe, as also Thomas Nagel, actually the writer of his book, Mind and consciousness is a fact. Is that just a function of neurons? Or is there an immaterial soul, actually? This is the problem of perception and personal identity in nature and qualia experience. Well, why are we conscious experiencers? Why do I see the color red, even though I cannot measure the color red? Well, physical stimuli, like sound, light, and so on, are translated into electric signals in the brain, and we can measure these even by neuroscientific methods. But we as living beings, the first person, the I experience them as images, colors, music sounds, gymnastics, physical education, pain, joy, whatever. I experience something and I cannot measure that experience. That experience seems to be orthogonal, another dimension actually, to reality than measurable, quantifiable things. So the question is, how can dead matter that just conforms to the laws of electrodynamics and the physical laws and so on, how can the dead matter actually start to feel, to think, to have intentions, to want, to desire certain things, and be an I, have an identity? How is that explainable by natural laws only, atoms moving around? The counter argument is usually, well, take away the brain, and there is no consciousness anymore. Okay, well, at least we cannot see consciousness anymore. We cannot be sure about that. As Christians, we believe that consciousness goes on after physical death. But the argument seems to be valid. But we can use a simple counterexample. For example, my cat loves to watch climate documentaries. I have polar bears. Polar bears are very popular with her. And when I want to see something else and I hate it, that she always sits in front of the TV, I can destroy the TV, yeah? And I can say, I destroyed the TV, the TV program is gone. There is no TV program anymore. Is that correct? No, the TV program is still there. Only the receiver, the transmitter of the TV program, that interacts with the program and can actually make me see the program, the receiver is destroyed, but not the program. So mental content is produced by mental causes and it can be transmitted via physical means, be it paper, be it electromagnetic waves, be it any physical mechanism on which you can transfer information or make the content. So the program, the TV program, is not a part of the TV, and it's not produced by the TV and by the electrical circuits of the TV. And I think the same could be true about our own feelings, about our perceptions, about everything. They run on the TV of my brain, but they are more than that. And when the brain gets damaged, yes, my transmitter, my receiver is not working that well anymore, but it doesn't say that there is no soul anymore. It's just the connection of the soul to the material world gets somehow out of order and damaged. And another good question that you can always ask even if you are not a scientist, can moral values actually be explained by evolutionary variation and selection? The problem of good and evil in nature. Nature and natural sciences only tell you what is the case, like the black widow spider feeds on their husband after being fertilized, and so on. And they are very, very successful doing that. So should we do the same as human beings? We observe that in nature it's a successful strategy. Should wives eat their husbands after they have received? No, probably not. So what we observe does not tell us what we should do. In evolution, you can always have different variations. And the successful variations in a certain environment will survive, and the other ones will go away. So that's the basis for evolutionary morality. Test different values, different behavioral strategies, and in the end, we'll find out what will survive. But is that good or bad? There are no moral values. It's only survival value. It's not a moral value. If there is no transcendent reference point of morality, of goodness and badness, then we have no morals at all. Morals are just subjective. And in the end, it's the law of the jungle. The one who is stronger and faster and can survive better will win over the weaker. And moral values usually restrict the stronger and the faster so that the weaker ones have also a chance to survive and live, because we believe that there is a dignity for all of life. The jungle does not believe that there is a dignity for all of life, I can assure you. So if there is no judge, of course, ultimately there is no justice as well, because we are not responsible to anyone. That's another good argument question you can ask in a podcast. And that's actually the end. My talk already. I hope I kept the time somehow. Suggested readings. You can find a lot of these books in the bookstore. And we produced these two documentary movies. If you would like to watch movies, they were on every computer and on European TV systems, not on American TV systems, unfortunately, because NTSC and PAL are different.